Good evening, folks. Welcome to our monthly lecture. Tonight, Bart Anderson and his wife Dolores, over by Kay Edwards and Mac, have come up to talk to us about the history of Southern Utah. Any special tinge on it, Bart?
Well, probably more Washington County, and probably a little bit about some of the early buildings of the area.
Okay.
That's true, isn't it? It's just kind of all Utah, isn't it? All black and burned Utah.
History, Bart, I'll turn it over to you.
Well, thank you, Lyman, and thank you very much for coming. A little bit about myself. I came here about 45 years ago. I'm unlike a lot of the natural-born people here. None of my family came from here. All my family came from Idaho. We were a group of dissidents. I was part of what they call the Morrisite Rebellion, my family was, which is kind of a fun thing, that's what got me into history. I got my degree at the University of Utah and minor in history. And, of course, I eventually went into medicine and became a hematologist. That's a bloodsucker. And I'm also the most undesirable person in our county because I am the county coroner. So please don't any of you take a nap while I'm doing my program. It really gives me a heart attack. But in general, uniqueness is the fact that over the last 45 years, I give probably 3 programs per day of these programs. I got 101 different subjects. I haven't gotten as nice as putting out on the PowerPoint because I've gone back to kept on slides. But before Kodak went out of business, I actually bought 6 of their slide projectors. So I think I'll last until I'm dead. But this evening's program is actually one of the very first that I started with. And it's a history called The History of Dixie. And you've got to remember that the history of Dixie encompasses a whole large area. Now, it did in the early days, before 1882, it was a very small county. There was a larger county to the south of us called the Rio Virgin County. And our county was really very small, but it had one very large town in it called Silver Reef. Silver Reef was so large that it was natural to think about taking the court records. Now, I should back up and say the court records came here in 1864 about 1859, and it came here in New Harmony, and then it was moved down to Washington, from Washington and moved eventually into St. George. But by 1882, there was a lot of people, especially down in Silver Reef, that thought, you know, this is a major metropolis down in Silver Reef. We need the court records brought down, changed from St. George up there. The people of St. George didn't want to allow that to happen. And so what they did is they went up to the territorial legislature. And before the 1882 election, they just put a huge block of property from up in by Enterprise, which was actually in Iron County, a big chunk of property over the east part of our county, which is Zion area, towns down below, into our county. So when the 1882 elections came, or the ballot on the box of whether the county seat would stay in St. George or go up to Silver Reef, stayed in St. George, which we're very lucky because not very many papers. I've got about 12 papers that existed from that I've found of the history of Silver Reef. But this is hopefully will give you a broad idea of what some of the unique characteristics in these pictures are. Again, my wife will say, out of all the lectures that I do, this is her favorite. And she must have heard it 1,000 times. I guess I don't know how to turn them. If I can face you a little bit here. I hope you all can see that. I always have questions when I get started in lectures. Why are the rocks red? And to understand this, I want to take you back, as geologists tell us, many millions of years ago, when this whole southwest corner of the state of Utah was covered by immense sand dunes. These sand dunes were so large that they were much bigger than the Sahara Desert, and they were sometimes at a point where they were actually 2 or 3 miles deep. Just a lot of silent sand. While the sand was being piled here, it actually, like putting too much weight on a cake or frosting on a cake, the cake caves in. Well, this whole landmass caved in, allowing a huge sea to penetrate off the Washington to Oregon coast. When that sea moved into this area, it brought with it a red stain. Now, we're not really sure because nobody is around here, but there's certainly good indications that the red stain probably came about because of Iron County up the way, because that red stain was hematite or iron oxide, which was a red stain that gave this the coloration to the rocks that we have around here. So when we look at the red color that we have here, it's all you're looking at is a piece of rusted rock. A lot of the rocks that we do have here that is white is the pure color of the sandstone before it was introduced into that red coloring. So when people ask you why the rocks are red, you now know that they're just rusted rocks. The next event that changed very dramatically was the fact that this landmass always changing. And the next event happened, and it's happening still today, and that is that this area was lifted up and huge plateaus were formed. Many of those plateaus were not even. For example, this one on this side is not as high as that one. So that presented a stress fracture right down here, which broke apart the rock and allowed, over the years, water to drain through. And water, of course, carved out beautiful canyons in the southwest. Actually, St. George would have been in the bottom of a very deep canyon had not been for another event, and that was this area was covered by immense lava flows. The lava that we have here, the majority of the lava that you see around here, actually comes from the base of Pine Valley Mountain. Pine Valley Mountain is kind of an interesting mountain because in geology terms it's called a laccolith. But all it is a huge blister on the Earth's crust. At one time, a whole big molten body just pushed that mountain up, just like a blister on the Earth's crust. And if you've got a blister on your heel, you know, after a while, walking on it gets very tender. Well, actually, stick it with a pin and drain the fluid off. Well, that's what happened. This big old blister called laccolith, Pine Valley Mountain, built up to the point where it popped right around the base, and it sent streamers of lava. And as the lava churned, they also formed large cavities of gas. Eventually, a gas would pop out in the form of cinder cones. Now, when we look at the 12 cinder cones we have in our area, in the county, I want you to realize these were not volcanoes. They're called volcanoes now in our commentary, but in actuality, they're simply were pockets where air was being vented out. But this would have been an aerial photo taken right alongside of 18, State Route 18, up on top of Snow Canyon. And it has always been called a volcano. And to relate this, back in 1949, they paved that road. When they always put a pavement on it, they put the county commissioners and the city mayors got in an official motorcade to clip the ribbon. They drove up the way. Well, just as they got up to that, looking at that cinder cone, a group of very enterprising high school students had carried a whole bunch of old inner tubes and tires into that cinder cone and lit them on fire. So here comes this official motorcade up the road. They're looking straight ahead, and this cinder cone is belching black smoke. So immediately they turn their motorcade around, race back to St. George, told everybody in St. George, you're going to have to evacuate, and then went to the extreme of having a team of geologists flown in from UCLA. You can just imagine how sad those geologists. Now, the interesting part of this story that I always like to relate is there was one of the little guys that was just a tyke, but he carried his own inner tube all the way up the top of that and dropped it in and made that fire. And that little tyke was named Dan MacArthur, our mayor down in St. George. So I guess everybody has a little skeleton in the closet. The next event that changed our area very dramatically was the introduction of human beings. We talk about this in the form of the Anasazi. Some of these people came here 2,000-4,000 years ago. Some of them maybe as short as 1,500 years ago. But while they were here, for some strange reason that we still don't really understand. I mean, there has been books and books written on it, but I can guarantee that nobody knows what they really mean. But the ancient ones came here and they actually scratched one rock against another, forming a series of marks which we call petroglyphs. And we have huge, mass pockets of these petroglyphs all over our area. The next event comes kind of cataloged into this area. I do a series of one-man plays, but one of the one-man plays I do is on Father Escalante. And we've got to realize that, as far as I'm concerned, these two men were very astute, in fact, of helping this area grow. Because they came here through here just as our Constitution was being forged back east in 1776. Father Escalante and Father Dominguez came through this area here in September. They are basically lost as they wandered through this area, kind of headed down toward Ash Creek, had to work across the Black Ridge where they actually were guided, and then their Indian guides took off right and left them halfway down the ridge and took off. But Father Escalante and Father Dominguez wrote some very inspiring words about this area as they walked through, because it was just getting autumn then, and it was cold where they had been. In fact, they were originally headed out for California by the northern route when they got up to Delta, or coming down by Delta, and they decided to go the southern route. And so they had been cold and miserable, And all of a sudden, they saw this beautiful valley, and they looked down in the ash creek, and they could see the trees still blossom. And they, again, wrote some very beautiful words about this area. And so I give them a little credit, or probably give a lot of credit to these men, because their maps were not very well done, but their journals were excellent. And I can't say exactly what it was. Anyway, Father Escalante and Father Dominguez, I like to say a lot about, because these men did so much for the establishment of this area. Now, a lot of pictures you're going to see tonight are preserved by this man. His name was James Booth. James Booth came into our area in 1863, not with the original pioneers, a few years after. The Booth family set up a small mercantile store, but they also brought with them a new development called photography. And photography became the crutch of the holding together the pictures that we've got of Southern Utah. So I like to give this family a little credit. Now, when they came down, they actually came down here with the regular pioneers actually to work and help the Indians. There was a series of forts that were built all the way from Salt Lake City down to San Bernardino, California. San Bernardino was a Mormon community. So Brigham Young did not want the tragedies of the Donner Party or the other part groups, Cape Martin and Willie Hancock Company. So he made sure that there was a set of forts, a set of communities all the way down the chain. And, of course, one of these would be our area down in Washington County, St. George. And as they came here, not only did they establish a little fort, but they also worked with the Native American Indians. These are what the Indians looked like back in the 1850s, probably, 1860s. I love this picture because that black line right up on top there, that's the airport. That kind of gives a geographical entity. You look at their dwellings, and people say to me, gosh, these people must have been really barbaric. And they really were. A French group of scientists came through here in 1854. They thought these Indians down in our region were the most barbaric. In fact, they called them Aborigines because they looked so different than any Indians they'd come across. First of all, our Native American Indians would cover themselves with red mud, and then they put black circles around their eyes. Well, you know, to a scientist, maybe back in 1854, this would look barbaric. But if you look at these people today, they got just as sunburned as you and I. The only difference was they didn't have any sunblock or copper tone. And so putting that red mud protected themselves, plus it gave them a little advantage of being close, being able to creep up on their prey, which they used a lot of rabbits, and they used big nets to capture the rabbits. And, of course, putting black around the eyes, gosh, all we have to do is turn on a Sunday afternoon baseball game and see our athletes put black around our eyes. So these Native American Indians that were living here were very, very practical. Also, the homes, this home here was also very practical, because what happened, this particular home, which you can see, it's kind of thatched. And what they do in the heat of the day or the afternoon when it was getting breezy, they take buckets of water, or should say, base of the water, and throw the water on the outside of that. And as the water came through, it would produce an air conditioner, just like our swamp coolers are today. So these Native American Indians, even though sometimes we forget their uniqueness, were very educated and living in a very harsh area. Well, I mentioned Jacob Hamblin came down here, and the pioneers came down and settled the area of Santa Clara in 1854. And it was one of the interesting notes because they had run out of food, so Jacob Hamblin came with a couple of other men, and they rode back up to Parowan to get a supply of food. And while they were on that journey, they were given a quart of cotton seeds that had been brought across the plains by some southern pioneers. And Nancy Anderson gave these to Jacob Hamblin and said, plant them down there and see if they work. Well, they worked. The first year, by golly, they produced almost 30 yards of cotton. Brigham Young was so impressed with the potential of this that he sent a group in 1857 to come down to southern Utah to establish a project of learning how to grow cotton. Now, these pioneers that came down here were originally from Alabama, Tennessee, Carolina. They knew how to grow cotton, but more than that, they were very proud of their southern heritage. And the people that settled in Washington, the little town of Washington, actually were the people who came up with the name of Dixie. And then Brigham Young was so impressed with this that a year later he called a group of young men, this time a bunch of bachelors, and they established a little experimental farm about where Bloomington now stands. And one of those youngsters climbed up on the cliff right above the walking trail or the Walmart store out in Bloomington and drew a picture of a cotton plant and then said, I was sent here to raise cotton and make molasses. Well, Brigham Young was so impressed that in October conference of 1861, he would call 309 families to come down here and establish the cotton mission, or the Dixie mission. And as they came here, this is an actual picture of the establishment of the early getting together, the pioneers up in Salt Lake as they made their monumental trek. Now they came down, the group that I'm talking about in 1861 came down very much the same way, the freeway. And they got to a point just down on the other side of the ash creek there, a place which we call the Black Ridge, but to them it was really a difficult place. They couldn't get their wagons down in the early days. They actually literally had to undo the wagons, put them on ropes, lower the ropes over the side of the cliff with the wagon pieces. Then once the wagons were put down at the bottom, they could drive out and away they go. But they actually had such a difficult time getting the wagons down there that a lot of times the families that would actually come here would go around the backside of Pine Valley Mountain, the old Spanish Trail. Now, this shows also another part of the story of the colonization down here. Of course, the Mormons came down here not only to build the forts, but also to teach the Indians to be more self-sufficient. And, of course, do some baptizing. This picture was taken March 20th, 1875, and it shows Daniel MacArthur baptizing and Augustus P. Hardy, Sheriff Hardy, witnessing. Now, after this baptism, all the Indians were given a clean shirt and a free meal. 2 weeks later, all of the Indians reappeared at the pond wanting to be rebaptized. This is a picture of the Booth family as they made their journey on the backside of Pine Valley Mountain, somewhere on the backside. Now, this is accredited as being the very first photograph taken in the St. George Valley. And it was actually taken up from the northwest section, up by the Brigham Young home, and it's shooting down below where the college is today. That was the early building up in that part of the town. It was called Sandtown, still called Sandtown by the old-timers. But the other part of the story is that down in the southeast area, down by the river, is a very marshy area. And that marshy area had brought with it the mosquito. And with the mosquito came malaria. The greatest crippler the pioneers had to face in the early days as far as health-wise was the dreaded disease of malaria. This is another picture showing again where the building was done in the early days. This was taken in 1876 from on top of the Mormon Temple, which was way out of town in those days. And it's looking up the northwest. Again, you can see where the majority of the building was done. Now, homes were always important. You know, the pioneers would set up a home, but the homes were very, very small. One or two rooms, very, very thick walls made of adobe, very high ceilings. And they always would make sure, again, like the Indians, they would make the position of the windows on the north and the south, because that's where we get our breezes in the evenings. And when the breezes came up, again, they learned from the Indians. They put burlap bags over the windows, and then they doused the burlap bags with water. The wind blowing through would create an air conditioner effect. And they found out that they could ward off a lot more of the dreaded malaria if they kept themselves during the rest night in cool area. So they tried to keep their houses as cool as they could. Now, this is a picture of what we call the big house. It's no longer there. This would be where the Zion Bank building right on the main drag of St. George is. Now, I certainly don't bring it to your attention to show you how grandeur the pioneers were, but I want you to realize that not only were there 309 families that were called here, but by another 10 years, Brigham Young would go through an enormous list of pioneers' names. And then especially during the 1870s, there was a famine and a terrible blight throughout the area. A lot of pioneers up in Idaho, southern Idaho, and central Utah, they didn't have welfare, they didn't have job service. Brigham Young called them on a work mission to come down to southern Utah and build the temple and the tabernacle. As they came down, they needed a place to stay. So this big house called the Erastus Stowe Home became one of the very first mission homes for these people that come. Now, as the pioneers came here, of course, they set up other schools were also a very important fact. They were all set up on a ward basis. They had four wards in St. George, so each one of the wards had a school. But the schools were different than we understand today. That is, a child wishing to go to school had to place the schoolmaster some type of commodity, whether it be coin, whether they didn't have. Mostly it was items like even a bread or a broom. And it wouldn't be pictured here until this picture in 1892 when we'd have tuition-free schools in our area. At the turn of the century, the city fathers were finding the young people, they were simply deserting this area. There was no form of higher education. So to keep these young people here in southern Utah, because this was not a very desirable place to be. Not until they embedded a golf course and a freeway and an air conditioner. This was a pretty dreadful area to be here. So pioneers went the extra mile. They got together and they established what they would call the St. George Steak Academy. The steak actually ran it. And now, of course, it's migrated into Dixie State College. But it was actually set up in the early days by the steak to keep the young people here. To cover all the buildings, I hope you've all toured some of these. If you haven't, you're missing a real treat. This is the old Pioneer Courthouse. Every Thursday, I'm there from 1 o'clock in the afternoon till 5 o'clock. And if you sneak in sometime, I'll even take you downstairs and show you where the jail cells are. The first floor had the administration offices. The second floor is the judges' chambers, where I hold a lot of my lectures. And then the top little tower, the cupola, it's not just put on for decoration. It was built and designed as an indoor hanging gallows, although no hangings ever associated themselves inside the building. Now, buildings were built in stages, and it used to be, boy, when I first came to Southern Utah to study history, I was baffled. I'd go into a building, and there'd be three plaques on different walls saying different dates. And then I realized that what happened was, as a room became functional, it was dedicated. Now, this is a picture of the old courthouse in 1869, and we know the exact date because this was April 1st, April Fool's Day. And as a practical joke, the young people of the community had taken the old cannon that sat in front of the courthouse and hauled it down the street, dumped it over into the manure pile. Oh, what a joke. Except the next day when the city fathers came out, it wasn't a joke to them, because that cannon was an outward symbol to the Indians of the defiance of these pioneers staying here. So the group of dignitaries comprised of the mayor and the councilman didn't take very long to find out who the culprits were. So they brought before the judge, and the judge declared that they should have penance. They should be. He realized it was an April Fool's joke, but it wasn't really that big of a joke. So he declared penance in three ways. First of all, their best wine, 10 gallons of the best wine, would be dedicated and sent to the court records. I don't know where it went from that point, but somebody must have drank it. And the second thing was that they would have to ride in an open procession to show the rest of the community how sad they were. And the young people that would ride in that procession as the cannon was being restored, as pictured here, are riding on the back of a jackass. So they had to ride the back of a jackass as the cannon was being brought. And of course, the third part was that they clean up the cannon and make it spotless. The next building is the tabernacle. You know, the pioneers took 13 years. This is one of the longest running operations I've ever come across. This is about as big a task, as far as I'm concerned, as length, as building the Hurricane Canal. Took so many years to build this building. And maybe you don't realize, but at the top of that building, it's kind of interesting, right along the top here, sometimes stop and look, there's an owl made out of wood. The pioneers carved and it's sitting up there today. Looks kind of formidable. But more than that is that four-sided clock. Now, the pioneers didn't have watches. And they had a water coming down the gutters in what we call water turns. And so it was really difficult. Arguments broke out all the time between pioneers when my water turn was over and your water turn started. So to stop those arguments, pioneers actually had in the 1870s installed that clock at a chiming bell. And what happened was that chiming bell and clock would jerk off the hour and stop the arguments. Sadly, when Utah became a state, that bell rang for 2 hours and 40 minutes, and it actually cracked. So we could actually honestly say we have our own cracked Liberty Bell down here in St. George. The building of the Mormon Temple was a much bigger project, I think, than the tabernacle, but it was done really quickly. It only took about 6 years, 1871 to about 1877. As it was finished, I want you to realize the outside pictured here is made out of, the building is made out of lava and sandstone, just like the tabernacle. The white is plaster. When the plaster was first put on here, in fact, when I came here 45 years ago, they used to have the same deal. They actually put plaster and they put glass particles in that plaster. So you look at the temple from afar, I mean, that thing was shimmering. But Oshie got upset with them because that was too dangerous, and so they've taken the glass out. But I do want you to know that underneath that white exterior is a building much like the tabernacle. Building of the tabernacle and the temple required large pieces of lumber. A lot of the lumber was spoken for of Pine Valley by the mining interest, so the Mormon pioneers had to go out to a place nobody else wanted to get to, called Mount Trumbull. some 80 miles out on the Arizona Strip and haul that timber in. This is an actual picture in 1876 of that operation out there on the Arizona Strip. Well, when the temple was completed, it was much different than we look at it today.
What?
Do you know who those men in the picture were?
I do at home. I don't remember that. The temple is a little bit different. First of all, you see there's a small tower on top, and then it looks like a castle tower. Let's start with the castle tower here. This is actually the water system. The water came through a spring, and then it was diverted into a little creek, and then a little drainage ditch, and then eventually into a pipe, and then the pipe fed into that water tank where it was actually pumped, hand pumped up in that water tank, and it was fed gravity by gravity into the baptismal font. The other thing that's different is that white little tower on top. We call it the squat tower. Now, Brigham Young came down here in 1876, and he was just a little bit dismayed about the fact that it was just not what he wanted. He had envisioned a tall, stately tower, but on the same note, he realized these pioneers had dedicated so much in the effort. And so the tower and the building was dedicated. Brigham Young himself would pass away a few months later. But a year later, October 16, 1878, a violent thunderstorm came raging through St. George, and out of that thunderstorm came a bolt of lightning. It came down, hit the top of that temple tower, and burned it right to the crisp. Right, square off. And inside, so they had to replace it. And each one of the pioneers replaced it, wrote in their diary. They did it just the way Brigham Young wanted to do it, because it was Brigham Young's fault that it got burned to start with. Also, you'll notice there's a dark-colored fence here around the temple. Brigham Young wanted a white picket fence, so the wagon train came in from California, and the white paint wasn't white, it was green, and the order was almost tripled. Well, back in those days, you couldn't call UPS and say, send it back, you had to keep it. So what happened, Brigham Young said to the people of St. George, if you will all put up picket fences, I'll supply the paint. Well, they had so much paint that they all painted the fences, they painted the houses, the outhouses, and the barn. Everything in the early days in southern Utah was green. So every time you walk down, you always see a historic monument as far as white picket fence, but always find at the end a green gate. A remembrance of the time when green was the color of southern Utah. Now, Brigham Young had made a prophecy that the St. George Valley, the temple would be the center of the St. George Valley. When I came here 45 years ago, this is the way it looked. We used to jokingly say our population and our elevation are about the same, 3,500. Now you can see we're 85,000 people. And the temple is now the center of the St. George Valley. Pioneers came here, of course, to grow and produce cotton. But as they settled aside their land, they had to put boundaries, and that was usually done by fencing. Well, they didn't have a lot of wood. But these pioneers, again, were an ingenious group of people. They went down to the river where they got multitudes of river willows, and they wove those fences together like you'd weave a basket. So all the fences were woven in those early days. And then by 1863, they had produced almost a third more cotton than they could use. So Brigham Young instructed them to build a cotton factory. The original plans called for the cotton factory to be up in Parowan, then it was eventually moved down to, never built in Parowan, but the idea eventually ended up in Washington. By 1865, the project was underway. You can see the tram, or the flume at the bottom back there where the water came in to drive the mechanism. By 1869, Brigham Young had brought down his woolen mill from Parley's Canyon, and this was a woolen and cotton mill. In fact, it was the largest cotton-producing factory west of the Mississippi. Now, one of the things about this is, I want you to realize the cotton industry was what the pioneers came here for, but on the whole, it was a poor business venture. None of us would want to invest it. But the pioneers found that that was a one idea. In fact, one of our great historians that I gained a lot of information from was a man by the name of A.K. Larson. He wrote, I Was Called Dixie. And A.K. said one time to me, he said, had it not been for the cotton factory and the cotton plant, the Dixie mission would have failed. This would have turned into a ghost town. But the pioneers kept here with the idea. Brigham Young said, we're going to do it, and we'll stay here, year after year, until we get it made right and make a cotton plant. But it seemed to be the glue that held these people here. Now, this is the second cotton factory. We have two cotton factories. We don't often talk about this one. You can see from this is a recent picture. But this is on the other side of the landfill, or you take the back road in from Sand Hollow back into St. George. You see it across the river. This is kind of a unique enterprise. This is part of the United Order, people from all over in Orderville. And it was a communal project. And anything they produced, whether it be a watermelon, or a cotton, would be grown and processed here, but it would be sent back over to the people over in the United Order. So basically it was a satellite right in the middle of southern Utah. These people had nothing to do with the people of St. George. The people of St. George had nothing to do with these people. By 1879, the project died out after Brigham Young died. So the United Order failed, and so this beautiful building still stands and stays as a tribute to this enterprise. Now, another one of the pioneers' dreams that was kind of like in cotton was the production of silk. They went over to the way and got lots of silkworms from the Orient, some from Europe, and they started the Silkworm Society. The idea would be a silkworm would go into a cocoon stage, and the cocoon would be stripped out to a mile in depth or length, they say. It sounded like, again, a pretty good idea on paper, but it never really materialized. Oh, there was a couple of gowns and maybe a couple of ribbons, but basically it was a poor business venture. But it did have one hangover, one carryover that we appreciate today. These little silkworms had to have something to eat, and that something was a fruitless mulberry tree. You'll notice adorned all our streets in southern Utah, we have mulberry trees. Simply a carryover at the time when the pioneers hoped that they could make their production in silk. Now, the one product that pioneers don't like, or people don't like me talk about, is a production of Dixie wine. And this is a part of your story here. Well, they had one time that you probably all heard this story, but I always like to recite it. One time that John D. Lee was recording in his diary that they had a 24 celebration, and they were having, like, you were setting all the games and play parties and events. But every time they'd get over, somebody would go over and get a drink. And it got to the point where they were drinking so much of this alcohol that it turned into a huge brawl, fist fight. And John D. Lee went home that night and said, "I am not sure whether I named this town right. I don't think it is a place of harmony." But whatever the case is, that wine was very well produced here. This area was very fertile, it was perfect for it. And that people say, well, how does that jive with the word of wisdom in the Mormon faith? Well, you got to remember the word of wisdom was made a word of wisdom. It would not be a commandment until June 9th of 1916. And the people down here were making a lot of wine that were doing very well. And there was really no rules on it. In fact, there's lots of cute stories over the way of Tokerville, because that was one of the main places. Whatever the case was, what happened to it? Well, the pioneers are kind of like us. They keep the best for us, and we give the worst to the Lord. And that's what the people of the pioneers' day were doing. They're paying their tithing in wine, because it could be measured out. And what they do is they give the top of the wine, which is vinegar, for tithing, keep the good stuff for themselves. And so by 1890, the church just had enough of it. They had thousands and thousands of gallons of vinegar. They couldn't even get rid of it. So what they did is they simply put a taboo, no more. The beautiful white vine vineyards came up. Now, I do want you to know that during the 1880s, it is said that they produced more wine in Washington County than any other place in the United States. That was a good business venture. Now, the pioneers had another interesting story, and that was that they didn't have money. Gold and silver was unheard of. Well, that was no big problem. They just simply printed their own money. And then about 1874, things were getting really bleak. In fact, it got to the point where literally people were thinking of moving away and just leaving St. George's as a ghost town. Just at that critical moment. Because what happened? Pioneer could make a watermelon grow, but who could he sell it to? Could he get any money for it? He had trade. But just at that critical moment, when the pioneers were about ready to leave, they found silver at Silver Reef. And a new epic sprang into existence. Now, Silver Reef became a two-edged sword. One side would be a place where they could sell their goods for hard cash. But also, the other side of that was the fact it was a rough and tumble town. In fact, one of the lectures that I have is on the outlaws and bad men of southern Utah. And a lot of them made their home in Silver Reef. Now, Silver Reef is kind of interesting because it has had a population anywhere from 1,000 people to 2,000 people. People had a hard time telling how many people, because miners were very transient. They'd come in and work in and go out very quickly. So it's hard to really get a count, but I like to go by the count, the fact that it had 9 grocery stores, 8 dry goods stores, 5 restaurants, and 6 saloons, making it one of the roughest, toughest towns in the West. Now, Silver Reef was actually growing together of 3 towns, Silver Reef, Chloride, and Bonanza. Just as 3 towns grew together, there were 3 distinct population bases. There was a group of Catholics, group of Protestants, and a group of Chinese, none of which wanted to be buried together. So up at Silver Reef, there are three separate cemeteries, one for each two groups. And a lot of great stories is you can stand over those cemeteries and realize what was the people that are buried under there. But also onto the scene came this man here, and he was a very dynamic Catholic priest by the name of Lawrence Scanlon. Father Scanlon came into southern Utah to take a little of this roughness out of the town. It didn't take very long before he became very close friends with Erastus Stone. In fact, every Tuesday, Erastus and Father Scanlon would have lunch together. And Father Scanlon one time said, you know, we're just about finished with our new Catholic church up in Silver Reef. As soon as we get this Catholic church finished, we can hold high mass. Now, high mass to a Catholic is a very important religious obligation. And what they did is, as they started thinking, or Erastus Stoll, Mormon apostle, started thinking, he said, Bishop, our Father Scanlon, why don't you just bring your congregation down to St. George and put on high mass in the St. George Tabernacle? We just got it finished. Well, Father Scanlon was really excited. He went up to his congregation, but the next week when he came back to the luncheon, he had a very long kind of a frown on his face, and he says, you know, I can't find a single soul who'll stand up and sing this high mass. Now, I can understand it's in the Latin text, but that didn't seem to slow down a Mormon apostle, Rastus. So he told this man in the center of this photograph, his name was John McFarland. He said, called John McFarland into his office, and he said, Brother John, Brigham Young called you down to St. George to establish the St. George Mormon Tabernacle Choir. I give you the responsibility with your group to learn this Latin Mass. So this Mass was actually practiced every Tuesday night, and on the third Thursday of May of 1878, the Mormons put on High Mass for the Catholics in the St. George Tabernacle. Business district. First of all, I got to tell you, you guys all know, but people I talk to down in St. George, we get white stuff called snow once in a while. And this is a good picture. The original meeting house was actually right here, the picture here. This was the St. George Hall. But it was way too small. Finished in 1864. It could only house about half the population. So that's why Brigham Young had him go down the street and build the tabernacle. And the next building down the way is the old Bishop's Storehouse. You know, if you attend care. Pardon?
Mrs. Platt, you leave.
Well, anyway, this is the old Bishop's Storehouse, and this is where you'd actually turn your money into commodities, or if you had 10 carats, you'd give one to the bishop. The building is beautiful architecture. Further down on the main drag of St. George. And then rotating over on the tabernacle, these buildings are still there. It's interesting, you walk around the back, you can actually see the building. All the new owners, they put new facades inside and remodel it inside. But the basic building, if you go around the back, is there. When these pioneers built something in the early days, they built it to last. Then the automobile comes onto the scene in the 1920s. This area was a boon. Because of the cars coming out on the desert, you can imagine needed service before they went on the desert. And one of the big motel developments, really wasn't a motel, but it was a place where a lot of people would stay and be right down the road from here, Harrisburg, or Long Valley, as it was called those days. This is another picture of the main part of town. You can see the tabernacle. During that period of time when the automobile came on. Now, also, this is another interesting photograph. This was taken in 1872. And it shows the old Gates Blacksmith Shop where the Mellon brothers were running. And this is where the men gathered together to do their manly bonding, you know, that they always do. Because they couldn't do that in the saloon because we didn't have any saloons. But that was either done at the Blacksmith Shop or the Higgins Barbershop taken in 1881. Picture. But it was quite evident that by the 1880s, the pioneers needed a place where they could have dances and hold plays and such. So they built the old St. George Social Hall. And that was actually built with contract labor that was, when the temple and the tabernacle was over, they couldn't just shuttle everybody back up the hole. They kind of had a period where they'd shuttle back so slowly. And so they needed some work projects to keep the pioneers going. So one of the projects they did was building the old Social Hall. Now, the social hall has a T-wing out the back. And it also has a kind of an interesting floor. I hope you've all seen it because it's on a level, on an angle. kind of like our movie theaters are built today. Well, that's great when they're putting a production on, but it'd be heck to dance on. So what they've done is they, pioneers were again ingenious because they put huge levers under the floor that they could turn, and they could level out that floor and put all the chairs underneath and have it for a dance. Well, by 1880, the pioneers had been able, 1890, excuse me, pioneers had been able to buy out an opera company back in New York City. They got the gowns and all the clothes and all the curtains, and this became known as the St. George Opera Hall. Now, one of the very first operas that was put on, or musicals that were put on in this building, shouldn't have raised any eyebrows, but after only one night's running, the city fathers closed down that production. Because during that production, the actors had allowed a woman to walk on stage wearing slacks. Pants on a woman was totally indecent. And so they closed down the production, and I can honestly say this is our only X-rated Southern Utah theater. Well, as that was used more and more for plays, pioneers went across the street where the dentist and eye billing clinic is. They leveled off the ground there and they built a dance hall called the Biz Ray. And that operated up until the 1930s. This is a great picture. This is a picture taken as the women were looking, getting out to vote. But look where they put the telephone poles, right down the center of the street. And then this is certainly one of my very favorite photographs of the 2,000 that I've collected. Got over a little over 2,000 photographs now of Southern Utah, but this is one of my favorite. It really doesn't date back to pioneer days. It dates back to 1918. But I remember so vividly my grandmother telling me this was a time of the great flu epidemic that spread its wings throughout the world and killed millions. Well, the people of St. George wanted to have their 24th of July celebration. Noticed each one of them have a white mask around their face to protect themselves from the dreaded flu. Now, each town always had a story about post office. Post offices were very important because that's the only way. They didn't have VCRs and TVs, so they needed to have knowledge of what was happening in the outside world through post office. It got moved several places until it eventually ended up in a place right around the corner from the courthouse in a building called the State House. Now, this is the mail coming in from the trailhead, train stop, and as the automobile replaced the horse, State House still continued to be the kind of the first gas and goodies along with being the post office. But by 1929, it had some unsavory reputations. It was said that there was some gambling going on in the back rooms. So what happened was the marshal would be called over from time to time to raid the building to try to catch the culprits, but was never able to. And then in 1929, the building had just dissolved overnight. Next week, headlines read, "Woe be unto those who gamble." I know a lot of our people that come to my programs anyway think about occasionally slipping down a mesquite. I always have, take one more look at this photograph. Our rodeo grounds actually is right in the area right behind the old library. That was the rodeo grounds in the early days. Where we have a rodeo today, Sun Bowl, Worthen Park. That was a very important part of the early pioneer days because as St. George and the area sprang into existence, it was really easy for an Indian family to come over and plop their tent on your front porch. That was very inconvenient. So what the city fathers did is they designated a square block area, and that was an area called the Indian Camp. And there the pioneers could come in and trade with the Indians, and the Indians had a place that they could stay. That's where the Worthen Park is. And this is a picture of that in 1892. Oh, floods? Oh, we have no idea. Dry as a bone out there, but I'll tell you what, the pioneers, they just about got driven away. 40 times they built dams on the Virgin River to have one after another washed out. In fact, this is one of my very favorite photographs, so I love to rub this into people. That white area, this is 1915 taken. That white area is the Virgin River, and at that time it's well over a half a mile across. Now, I would be very leery to buy a piece of property in Bloomington Hills when I see this piece of picture. Now, building the bridge across the Virgin River back in 1912 was another big event because a lot of the farmland was on the east and a lot of the homeland was on the west, and if the river flooded over, you're just all cut out of luck. But they built this as a project 1911-1912, and it became the bridge that spanned the river. Sadly, when the Quail Creek dike broke a few years ago, washed away this beautiful out of us, and now again we only have it in a few pictures that exist. Story of polygamy. These are all men from southern Utah. We could have a whole series of programs on this. In fact, I've been kind of lucky over the years. I've been, to my knowledge, the only one that's been able to go out to their area on two occasions and actually tell them their own history of their development. But a lot of people came to southern Utah hoping to get away from it. Now, President Wilford Woodruff in 1896 had a good way of doing it, because right down on the inside of Bloomington, there was a beautiful pond. It was where Sun River is now, called Atkinville. And the Atkin family had taken that pond and made it into a place where they could get water for their irrigation. It also had a lot of fish in it. But the most notable story is the fact that they built a very special boat. And this boat was outfitted with bedroll and food and books. And when the marshals would come down looking for President Wilford Woodruff, he'd get on this boat and push himself into the bulrushes. And he could elude the officers for upwards of 2 weeks. So kind of an interesting point. Sadly, it got washed away back in right after the turn of the century. You know, they didn't have the VCR, again, the TV. The real love was music. Music was a drawing edge. In fact, it's interesting to note that one out of every three pioneers were called in southern Utah in the early days had a knowledge of a musical instrument. That was their only real relaxation, was music. Get away from the heat of the summer. They had a place in southern St. George. It's no longer there. It's called Dodge's Pond. Been around by where the Elks Lodge is. There's one little lip of it there. But Dodge's Pond was made into a garden. Beautiful flowers and grass, and they had gazebo, had boat rides, they had swimming. It was a really very cool place in a hot place where they didn't have a lot of air conditioning. The sad part was about 1932, the water was dropping. We had a real dry year like we have had this last couple of years. As the water dropped, the owners, the Dodge family, thought, well, we'll just simply dynamite the spring and open it up and get more water to flow out. Well, they dynamited the spring, but they did the opposite. It closed the water off. And so the lake dried up. And all we have is a few pictures of this pond are the ones that exist through Pioneer. I love this picture. It's taken in 1870. Every time I look at this picture, the one thing comes to notice, mine, and that is how this is how the pioneers back in 1870 went out dragging Main Street. Now, the pioneers kind of had, like you guys are having tomorrow, a very special day, but they had a very special pioneer day down in our area, the lower part of the county, and it wasn't really on any particular day. It just so happened to be a day when they get all the crops into the ground. And once that happened, all the towns, Santa Clara, St. George, and Washington, even communities far up in New Harmony, would go down there and have a big town picnic. And after they had the town picnic, they had the races, and they always had the shotgun shoots. And if you look real carefully, you can see two women holding shotguns on this side, blurry spot here probably where the plate or whatever they were shooting at. This is a picture of Buffalo Bill. He came to our area in 1892. He and Brigham Young's son come up with some harebrained idea of making a great castle over on the north rim of the Grand Canyon to lure dignitaries and kings and queens over there to hunt. But he spent a unique time, a series of times, so did Teddy Roosevelt in our area. But this one here is he's looking very conscious of the outside world, looking at him. He kind of poses very much there while all the pictures were taken. Picture of the old hearse. This is taken to the cemetery in style. Now you look at the faces of these people, you realize the dedication. You know, they came here not because they wanted to. They came here because they were told to. And in those days, they were married together and they were buried together. And the family unit, oh, that was important. And I know sometimes when the newcomers come here and they get here, they're tired of hearing family, family, family. Well, let me tell you what, the family is what kept this place going. The family dedication to each other kept the southern Utah going. Because this was not a very desirable place down here in southern Utah. In fact, I consider it one of the hardest of the harsh missions that the pioneers ever faced. And as they did, they carved out a little existence, a beautiful place that we're pretty proud of today. And it kind of brings me to the conclusion of this evening program But I ended up a little different because we had a very noted country and western singer that came to our area a few years ago by the name of Marty Robbins. Mr. Robbins came to our area while he was recuperating from a heart attack. He was so impressed with this area that he would write three songs about Southern Utah. And what I'd like to do is close out my program with one of these songs that really has my feeling, my essence of spending my 45 years here and studying the history. It's called The Red Hills of Utah by the late Marty Robbins. Yeah, thank you. Thank you very much.
Did you notice after he turned around it didn't even affect his presentation? He knows which slide's coming of all 101 presentations he's got. An amazing man.
Thank you.
And an amazing woman to put up with him.
Yeah.
My eyes get so heavy. She's
any,
the only one that was sitting over here going.
Any questions for Ranger Bart?
I would like to make a comment.
Uh-huh.
With New Harmony, I'm a
great-great-grandson
of John D. Lee. Uh-huh. And to kind of set a few things straight, New Harmony, in 1847, of course, the center of Utah. There was no St. George at the
time. Uh-huh.
Okay. And anyway, New Harmony, now my great-great-grandfather came here. I was just telling you some good style. They had, he said it was the first book. And brought all the stuff, and of course, with the Lee, sometimes it's not very pleasant after that last night because of things that happened that were not in that message. But a lot of people just took the things and don't talk very much about And John gave me these flowers on the thing. It was interesting. I see all the other pictures. It was when he first went down into Washington County. And he wrote in his diary with possibly 50 families.
Didn't think too much of it.
And he built one of the first homes in Washington. Of course, he was really noted as the founder of Washington.
For Polly and Lavina, it's a great, great story. We can go into a whole bunch. We can go into some great stories on that house was built down there.
To set another couple of records straight about the Cotton Nation, he was announced in a conference in Salt Lake City by Brigham Young. He was the doctor's son. And he was announced that he was in charge of the Cotton Nation in Washington County. That's very seldom recognized. There were very few people when they came to Washington County. John B. Lee was really quite the instigator of the conservation, if you really go back and check. And what happened there was a few families were sent down to try and establish a cotton mill in St. Cloud. There weren't very many people there. St. George wouldn't have existed until 300 people got out here later. Anyway, I just wanted to make a few comments that my grandfather, in his diary, states he ran 1,000 head of horses and cattle in the stock.
Well, I'll add one little piece to your history. Those that were called from Tooele to settle in Santa Clara, they first settled in St. George before the colonists were called to St. George.
Yeah.
The first settlers in St. George were Levites.
But they
now,
and they're still there.
And now they have taken over Southern Utah.
They have.
Any other?
Yes.
Some of the first pictures you showed of the
Petroglyphs,
where are they located?
They're called Land's End, right over by the other side of Ivins.
Is that of Ivins?
Yeah. Actually, I counted right within 20 miles of St. George, 111 different sites.
Is that right?
So we got lots of petroglyphs.
Any other comments, questions?
So when are you going to do the end up here? Not this one, but the other one.
When they asked me to. I do whatever I... Down in St. George, I anchor the Historical Society for Washington. I do a program there once a month. I do one for Hurricane and one for St. George. So I do three programs a month in the different places.
What was the day when you said
you're
down in St. George?
I'm at the Pioneer Courthouse every Thursday afternoon between 1 and 5, and I usually use that because I do a lot of ghost towning, and people want to go to ghost towns, they come and let me show them how to draw a map to get to that ghost town or something. So I'm there every Thursday afternoon to answer questions.
Bart, when I got off my mission and walked into that courthouse, they showed me that I was number one on the draft list.
Uh-oh.
So I joined the Air Force.
I have a question.
Yes. Well, you know, the courthouse. The courthouse was not something that St. George invented. The courthouse is very common. Its style came all the way back from Illinois. They had three or four of them in Illinois, just like it. And so it was also there's two of them in Nevada. So what I'm saying is that the actual schematics and stuff just simply put it there as part of the building. It wasn't invented by them when the Mormons pioneered. They already had the building. I guess what they wanted to do was to make it so that it would be less offensive, you know, to the outside world. The problem is that they already, in the story of the St. George and the history of Bad Men, they actually had a hanging that happened right outside the courthouse. They didn't wait to take him into the courthouse. They just hung him out on a tree outside the courthouse. So.
Didn't I hear you right, Bart, that they had no hangings in that?
Never had any hanging inside. They had one hanging outside, but none inside.
Well,
just want to make sure Michelle didn't.
You don't want to go down there and get hung. That's why.
Any other comments or questions? Thank you so much for coming, and hope we'll see most of you tomorrow. We're going to have a great day of activities.
For coming.
My pleasure. Thank you for inviting me.
Thank you so much.
Oh, my pleasure. I enjoyed it too.
I asked about those people in Mount Trumbull because my great-great-great-whatever-grandfather Blake had the...
Oh, he was part of the... He had the Blake Mill, huh?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
I was wondering if one of those men might have been...
I can't remember whether that's... whether Blake's in that group or not, but if you call me up on the phone, remind me, I'll look it up, because I actually have a copy of who's who.
Oh, great.
Thank you, Mark.
Oh, thank you.
I hope it came out okay. Yeah.